Mr. Chairman, one of my brothers. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, I feel very honored, it's an honor to me to be able to come back to the Militant Labor Forum again this evening. It's my third time here. I was just telling my brother up here that probably tomorrow morning the press will try and make it appear that this little chat that we're having here this evening took place in Beijing or someplace else. They have a tendency to discolor things in that way to try and make people not place the proper importance upon what they hear, especially when they're hearing it nowadays from persons whom they can't control, or, as my brother has just pointed out, persons whom they consider irresponsible. But it's the third time that I've had an opportunity to irresponsible. But it's the third time that I've had an opportunity to be a guest on the Militant Labor Forum, and I always feel that it is an honor. And every time they open the door for me to do so, I will be right here. The Militant newspaper is one of the best in New York City. In fact, it's one of the best everywhere you go today, because everywhere I go, I see it. I saw it even in Paris about a month ago. They were reading it over there, and I saw copies of it in some parts of Africa where I was during the summer. I don't know how it gets there, but if you put the right things in it, what you put in it, we'll see that it gets around. Tonight, during the few moments that we have, we're going to have a little chat, like brothers and sisters and friends, and probably enemies too, about the prospects for peace or prospects for freedom in 1965. But you notice I almost slipped there and said peace. Actually, you can't separate peace from freedom. No one can be at peace unless he has his freedom. You can't separate the two. And this is the thing that makes 1965 so explosive and so dangerous. The people in this country who in the past have been at peace and been peaceful were that way only because they didn't know what freedom was. They let somebody else define it for them. But today, 1965, you find those who have not had freedom and not in a position to define freedom, they're beginning to define it for themselves now. And as they get in a position intellectually to define freedom for themselves, they see that they don't have it. And it makes them less peaceful or less inclined toward peace. So in discussing this topic tonight, prospects for freedom in 1965, I think we have to go back at least 12 years or 10 years to the time when the struggle of the black man in America began to be projected into the limelight, not only in this country, but throughout the world. It started primarily with the Supreme Court decision, so-called desegregation decision, and I should say so-called desegregation, so-called decision, because there has been some doubt as to what they really handed down. One of the main ingredients in the struggle of the black man in America for the past 12 years has been the black Muslim movement. No one can deny the role that the black Muslim movement has played in America during the past 12 years, has been one of the main ingredients in the stepped-up militancy on the part of black people throughout this country. No matter what direction the black Muslim movement itself was headed in, no matter what its own organizational philosophy was, and no matter what other people thought about it, no matter what their personal opinions were of the black Muslim movement, still it cannot be denied that that movement, because of its uncompromising stand, an uncompromisingly militant approach to things, forced other civil rights organizations to be more militant than they normally would have been, and forced many of the civil rights leaders definitely to be more militant than they ever would have thought of being. So the militancy of the black man in America during the past 10 years, in my opinion, can be traced largely to the existence and presence of the movement, which I'm referring to now for purpose of identification as the Black Muslim Movement. Its contribution to the black struggle for freedom in this country was militancy. It made many of our people dare to get loud for the first time in 400 years. Many of the black leaders of the civil rights movement dared to get loud for the first time. I mean really loud for the first time in nearly 400 years of our being in this country. They got more militant than they intended to be, and they made many of the people become more militant than they intended for the people to be. It had a chain reaction effect that actually got out of control somewhat, because the leaders themselves never intended and never do intend for our people to go too far. Their primary purpose in our midst has always been to contain our struggle, not lead our struggle. Proof of which, seldom are they seen until the irresponsible elements in the black community begin to explode. And then they go all the way around the country to grab one of them from wherever he's traveling and bring him in to cool things down, to tell us to be cool, or tell us to take it easy, don't rock the boat. This is their function, this is their role. At least it has been up until recent times. They never have been put in the role that they're in with the intention by the one who puts them there of them leading us into any uncompromising and militant struggle. But the existence of some of the Muslim groups and the black nationalist groups that couldn't be controlled by the power structure downtown, and I only use the expression power structure downtown to keep from calling it what it actually is. These nationalist elements actually serve their purpose in that sense. They gave respectability to the civil rights groups and gave acceptability to the civil rights groups. 10 years ago or more, the NAACP was looked upon as a radical, leftist, almost subversive movement. And then when the black Muslim movement came along, the power structure said, thank the Lord for Roy Wilkins and the NAACP. This is true. Pick up any newspaper that was printed 10 years ago and read what was being said about CORE and NAACP and Urban League and some of these other groups. They were considered irresponsible. They were considered moving too fast. They were considered almost extremists. And then when they looked around one day and found someone talking about all of them were devils, they were all night looking up Roy Wilkins and James Farmer and the Right Reverend Dr. King and some of the others to soothe them and keep them thinking that all of our people didn't think like that. So it did contribute its part in the struggle. It made Roy Wilkins acceptable and honorable and responsible. And sometimes today I think he's forgotten what we've done for him. This is one of the reasons why Tom Mboya has lasted so long in Kenya. During the Mau Mau uprising, when white people were scared to death, not only in Kenya, but throughout Africa, and not only in Africa, but throughout the world, Because there were people who looked just like the Kikuyu right here in New York, in Mississippi, and other places. When Mau Mau was on the rampage and Jomo Kenyatta was given the image of a monster, because his own image was so ghastly in the sight of whites, the image of Tom and Boya immediately became acceptable, because Kenyatta seemed to be so irresponsible and Boya became responsible. He became acceptable, responsible, you know, and made everybody happy. So they supported him, they backed him up, made him prominent throughout the world. Kenyatta made him. He didn't make himself. And he was intelligent enough to know it. So when Kenyatta got out, he supported Kenyatta. He realized that the contribution of Kenyatta made him what he was. And because he was intelligent enough, he was blessed with sufficient insight to see the role that Kenyatta and the Mau Mau played in his own prominence, an image of respectability and acceptability. He continued to support Kenyatta, and today he's still a part of Kenyatta's government. And I must take time right here to point out that that's a good study in itself. It took the Mau Mau to bring independence not only to Kenya, it took the Mau Mau to bring independence to most of Africa. When a man is sad over his miserable condition, he does nothing to change it. Sadness doesn't change anything. It's only when he gets mad that he changes it. It takes madness to change it. One of the things I noticed when I was in Africa traveling around, I noticed many Africans who were still colonized, still exploited, still oppressed. And one of the things all of them had in common was they seemed sad, they would discuss their sad plight, but they weren't ready to really do anything to change it. They seemed to be waiting on some miracle. But the contrasting difference between them and what happened in Kenya, the Kikuyu got mad. They just didn't care what the consequences were. They knew they cared nothing about legality, morality, or anything. All they knew was that they were being oppressed unjustly, illegally, immorally. And because of this unjust, illegal, immoral oppression that they were suffering, they came to the conclusion that they would be within their rights to bring it to a halt by any means necessary. And they adopted those means. When they began to use these means in their struggle for freedom, the press of the West began to project them in a very negative image. They were freedom fighters. They were African patriots fighting against oppression. They weren't fighting against a legal government. They weren't fighting against a moral society. They were fighting against a colonial power, an imperialist power, a vulturist society. And this vulturist society, with its control of the press and its allies here in the United States, who also control much of the press, projected these freedom fighters, these African patriots, in the image of savages, cannibals, terrorists, some as criminals, actually. And they projected Jomo Kenyatta in an image worse than all. But the Mau Mau weren't image conscious. They weren't status seekers. They weren't social climbers. They wanted freedom. And they came to a conclusion at a point in their journey that the only way there was to get it was the way they did it. And they got it. I admire them for that. I respect them for that. Now that they are free, Jomo Kenyatta, whose image was that of a monster 4 years ago, is the president of Kenya. He's respected. So much so that when the hostages were being held in Stanleyville and no one else dared to do anything about it, they called on Jomo and asked him would he sit down and mediate between the American ambassador, Atwood, there in Kenya, and Tom Kanza from Stanleyville, the same man that the West had projected as a monster. They had to call on him. And when you go to Kenya today, you will find white people in Kenya praying that Kenyatta doesn't die. The same, yes, they're praying, and they should. They are praying that he doesn't die. The same man that a few years ago was projected as a monster, as an extremist, as being irresponsible. Now they say he's the most responsible head of state on the African continent. So the difference between being projected as an extremist or a monster is only depends upon who controls the projection. If you project your own image, then you are able to project a positive image. But when your enemy is your master, and when your enemy masters the press that's going to create this image and project it abroad, then naturally your enemy is going to project you in the image of a monster. So I say, and I must say, because a reporter was asking me a few moments ago to either confirm or deny the statement that mentioned where I said we need a Mau Mau in the United States. I never would deny that. Why, we need more than a Mau Mau in the United States. I mean, actually, a person have a lot of nerve to ask me that. In a society, I'm deviating now because they put me off the track. I got to deviate. In a society where in 1964, three civil rights workers can be murdered in cold blood, and not the Mississippi government, the federal government, can't do anything about it, I say, we need a Mau Mau. When a Negro educator can be murdered in Georgia, and they know who murdered him, and the government can do nothing about it, I say, we need a Mau Mau. And I'll be the first to join it. And a lot of people that you don't think go for it will line right up behind me. So getting back to the Black Muslim movement, that you have to understand it in order to understand pretty much what has taken place in the civil rights movement in this country during the past 10 years. And in order to understand what might take place in 1965. The Black Muslim movement attracted the most militant young black people in this country. The most restless, the most impatient, and the most uncompromising black men and women were attracted to the Black Muslim movement. But the movement itself, as it began to grow, actually was maneuvered into a vacuum, in that it represented itself as a religious movement, and the religion under which it identified itself was Islam, and the people in the part of the world who also identified that as their religion did not accept the Black Muslim movement as a bona fide Islamic or Muslim movement. They never did accept it as that. So it was put in the position of going by a religion that rejected it, which put it into a vacuum or made it a religious hybrid. On the other hand, the government in Washington, I guess that's where it is, tried to label the Black Muslim movement as political. It used the press, it maneuvered the press to project the Black Muslim movement in an image that would enable the government itself to list it as political, and therefore label it seditious and subversive and step in and stomp it out like it stomps out most bona fide freedom movements that appear in this country. So the Black Muslim movement was not only a religious hybrid, but it became a political hybrid, in that it was more political than religious. But at the same time, it didn't take part in politics. It didn't take part in the civil rights struggle. It took part in nothing that black people in this country was doing to correct conditions that existed in our community, other than it had a moral force, that it stopped our people from getting drunk and taking drugs and things of that sort, which is not enough. After you sober up, you're still Paul. So it became in a vacuum. It actually developed, it grew, it became powerful, but it was in a vacuum. And it was filled with extremely militant young people who weren't willing to compromise with anything and wanted action. More action, actually, than the organization itself could produce. More constructive action and positive action than the hierarchy of the organization was qualified, actually, to produce. The main objective of the movement was land.